If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Now, a steel monolith that was recently discovered in the American desert has now disappeared as mysteriously as it appeared. The monolith was first found earlier this month by rangers in the Utah desert during a wildlife survey. No one officially knows who created the object or what it was Monolith.
A large, single, upright block of stone.
Requesting permission to investigate monolith.
Can I deny permission on that one?
Okay.
Greetings, friends. It is I, D. Trussell. This is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. That song you just heard was called Mysteries of the Monolith. It's from Gerald Duruney's new album, Monolith Songs, which is going to be available on Magna Rex Records in July. Today has been one of my favorite days of all time, so I'm going to bore you with it. I woke up early with the baby, made breakfast for him, grits and this incredible banana pancake recipe that I found on a diet app because I want to lose weight. It's, you basically take 2 eggs and 1 banana and you mix them together, and then you use olive oil. I think I'm not supposed to use that oil, and you cook the pancakes. I think this is essentially a crepe, but I haven't taken the time to look up crepe recipes. And then you add yogurt and blueberries to it. So I made these banana pancakes and grits for Forrest. And in all my life, I can't think of much that is more pleasing than listening to your kid eat food and in between bites say things like, yummy, 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 I don't know, like, it. All my years of hedonism, all the money spent on a variety of psychotropic cocktails to induce pleasant states of consciousness, nothing compares to just something as simple as that. And then I came to the studio and I had one of the greatest conversations maybe I've ever had with today's guest, Douglas Rushkoff. All thanks to Connor Habib, who connected us. It's a great conversation you're about to hear. Rushkoff is a genius, and you're about to find out why. We're going to jump right in to this podcast, but first, this. My dear friends, it's the season to curl up, sleep in, and get cozy, which means you can't go wrong giving comfy gifts for the holidays. And with Purple, you can give the gift of comfort and great sleep to everyone on the list. Purple is a sleep company that's been innovating comfort for over 15 years with their proprietary Purple Grid technology. Purple's best-selling Harmony pillow is made with their signature grid and provides absolute airflow. It's the perfect gift to help keep the hottest of heads cool. Wrapping a mattress in Purple's silky, soft, breathable sheets will have every sleeper wanting to hit the snooze button even more. Whether you're working in an office or at a kitchen table, sitting all day no longer has to be a pain in the butt. Purple seat cushions offer no pressure support and keep you comfortably cool. And if you got sweet little ones out there, Purple's Kid Collection has all the essentials to help them dream big. They've got super soft, moisture-wicking kids sheets and the cradling support of a kid's pillow. Look, I'm reading what they want me to read there, but I gotta tell you, I have a purple pillow and it's awesome. I don't know what it is. It's a grid. They say it's a grid. It's the only time I've been tempted to cut something open just out of curiosity of what's in there, because it really feels weird in the best way possible. I don't mean bad weird, good weird. It's like this is what they would lay on in a UFO. It's because I know by now with all the various mattresses out there and pillows, you might have pillow fatigue, but I'm telling you, purple is real. There's hope. It's not just endless iterations of the same pillow. Purple is an actual thing that seems like it fell out of some kind of spiral into another dimension. It's a sign that we truly are approaching the Renaissance. Give the gift of comfort and great sleep with Purple. Go to purple.com/Duncan10. That's purple.com/Duncan10 and use promo code Duncan10. For a limited time, you'll get 10% off any order of $200 or more. That's purple.com/Duncan10. Promo code Duncan10 for 10% off any order of $200 or more. purple.com/Duncan10. Promo code Duncan10. Terms apply. We're going to jump right into this episode of the DTFH, but first I want to address something that has happened so that y'all hear my side of the story. I'm sure by now you've heard that listeners of the DTFH have been experiencing a variety of attacks from birds and small animals. Many of our listeners have sustained pretty severe wounds, beak wounds, from flocks of crows coming out of nowhere, as I'm told, and just falling upon them, attacking them. They go for the eyes, apparently. So, fortunately, the people who were attacked by these flocks were wearing glasses or covered their eyes so that they weren't blinded. They go for the nipples. I didn't know this about crow attacks, but if they can get through your shirt, they're going to try to rip your nipple off your chest. They use it for their nests. They feed their youngs with it. Here's what I know. These attacks are happening to listeners of this podcast. And I've had my research team look into these attacks, the squirrel attacks that happened in Portugal. Horrible, horrible. Somebody lost a pinky to that, to three squirrels who apparently were passing it among each other, not eating it, but just weirdly passing it to each other, holding it in their mouths and giving it to the next squirrel. Fucked up. The weasels in Sweden, ferrets, whatever you want to call them, I guess some ferrets made their way out of an aquarium and did some damage to the back of a listener's neck. Stitches. What they all have in common is that they weren't subscribers to my Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/DTFH. And this is not some veiled threat. I am not orchestrating these animal attacks. I'm not using sonic beams to send random packs of small animals after my listeners. That would be horrible. I love all my listeners, not just the folks who have subscribed to my Patreon. And I have a team of lawyers if anybody wants to come at me and try to be fancy and say that I had anything to do with any of these attacks. I didn't. But I will tell you what every single person subscribed to my Patreon has not sustained any attack from any small animal in the last many months. And that is a kind of assurance, I guess, all of you can have, that if you subscribe to my Patreon, not only will you have access to commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, not only will you be able to join us three times a week for our Tuesday group meditation, Journey into Boredom, our Wednesday book club, where right now we're reading Grist for the Mill, or our Friday family gatherings, not only will you have instant access to our massive, ever-growing library of content. Not only will you be able to experience the association of your family on our Patreon Discord server, but you will protect yourself from the possibility that one day while you walk outside to go to your car, you suddenly get attacked mercilessly by animals that up until that point you probably thought were cute. And I can't guarantee that the animal attacks aren't going to start happening with bigger animals. Bears, pit bulls, alligators. There's a lot of big animals out there, folks. A lot of big animals. And if someone had a way to control them, woo-hoo! You know, I'm sorry. I've just been reading this book, How to Create a Successful Podcast. And like the first rule is, in the first 5 minutes of your podcast, try to threaten your audience and terrify them into joining your Patreon. If you guys don't join the Patreon, it's fine with me. I'm just happy that you listen. And I got to tell you, podcasting, it's my favorite thing to do on the planet because I get to have conversations with people I normally would never have a chance to interact with. Douglas Rushkoff has been named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. And they meant it. He is brilliant. He's written a plethora of books. Is that how you say it? Plethora? Plethora? Plethora. That sounds like somebody who fights dinosaurs in the ancient times. He's written many great books. I wasn't named one of the top intellectuals by MIT. I can't pronounce plethora. Plethora? I'm not going to look it up. Regardless, thanks to Connor Habib, I connected with Mr. Rushkoff and we had the conversation that you're about to hear. Definitely check out his book, Team Human. It's amazing. Not only is he a great philosopher, he's a really good writer. All right, everybody, strap in and welcome to the DTFH, the great Douglas Rushkoff. Welcome to the DTFH, Douglas Rushkoff. Thank you so much for being here. Do you want me to call you Doug or Douglas? How do people refer to you?
Douglas is kind of more fun for me.
Okay, Douglas it is. Awesome. Douglas it is. So I'm just going to start off with this beautiful passage from your book, Team Human. We're moving from one understanding of our place in things to another. The Renaissance may have brought us from tribal to the individual, but our current Renaissance is bringing us from individualism to something else. We're discovering a collective sensibility that's more dimensional and participatory than the unconsciously formed communities of the past. We had to pass through the stage of individualism in order to get there. Wow, this is the best. And the weird thing about the experience of the world right now, I think, is that maybe more people than would admit it have this odd sense that we are on the precipice, not of some catastrophic thing, but some kind of renaissance. And yet I had no way to really make sense of that until I started reading this chapter in your book. And I wonder if you could go deeper into it for us.
I mean, sure. I mean, it happens in a way. The easiest way to understand it is how it happens in a human being. You know, a baby is born and it thinks it's one with its mother. And that's kind of like our kind of more original indigenous first people stage, you know, one with the planet. We're just part of this bigger mother organism. And then you kind of develop your sense of separateness. Oh, that's my mom and I'm me, you know, and you
yes.
get your terrible twos and threes. No, I'm a part. I have my ego. I'm something. It's about me.
Yes.
And you see the kid all selfish and my toy and give me this, you know, and all that until they get to be about adolescent. And then they're like, ooh, look at those other people over there. I kind of want to touch them and, you know, get them inside them and them inside me. So you want to break down your ego to then become a real adult, an intimate adult. And I feel like that's kind of where we are as a society now is we had our kind of tribal phase. Then we moved through to the Renaissance. And the Renaissance, you know, it was both bad and good. You know, the good thing is that we invented really or reinvented the individual. The Renaissance is the rebirth. That's what the word means, to rebirth of old ideas in a new context. So we rebirthed all those ancient Greek notions of the individual and, you know, and the central state and the authority and all. But the Vitruvian man, you know, that image of that guy standing in like a cross or an X, sort of this perfect human individual. That's when we got the individual. And all the Renaissance inventions were really based on the individual perspective. You know, we got the printing press, so everybody got their own Bible and could read it and interpret it individually. We got Protestantism, which is about your individual salvation. Mm. We got perspective painting, which is about this is how this looks from a particular point of view. You know, so all of these things, it was a new dimension that each person has their own perspective, and it got us to the Enlightenment and one man, one vote. And individual rights and beautiful stuff. But now we're in a place where it's like, wow, we've really pushed this cult of individual thing a bit too far, right? You know, we have you, you're the one. You deserve a break today. It's the me generation. It's about you. Because consumerism loves individuals because we don't want, you know, we don't want you sharing a lawnmower with your neighbor. We want you get your own lawnmower and they get their own lawnmower. Right. And more jobs and more stuff and individual. But now we're like, we're realizing, well, wait a minute. And I do believe, and this is sort of the way I looked at the rise of the internet and digital technology back in the late 80s and early 90s. I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be the next Renaissance. The last Renaissance, we got perspective painting. This Renaissance, we get fractals and holographs.
Yes.
You know, the last one, we got circumnavigation of the globe. This one, we orbit the globe from space. You know, the last one, we got the printing press. This one, we get the internet and the computer. You know, so each of the things that we got, you know, are kind of the new levels of dimensionality, where the last one we got the individual, this one we get this kind of fractal, collective, multiplicity, kind of rave-like, collective point of view.
Yes.
And as a result, the things that get rebirthed are the opposite of what got rebirthed last time. In the last Renaissance, we got the corporation, the chartered monopoly, we got central currency, we got colonial powers and expansion and exponentialism and linear thinking. This one, we're going to get the opposite, and we are. We're getting all those medieval things that got repressed, witchcraft and women and craft beers and hands-on and, you know, occultism. And all these new, the I Ching, I mean, the sensibilities that were really repressed the last time out end up rebirthed now. So assuming we can make it through this strange labor that we're in, I'm really hopeful about what this new Renaissance can bring.
The book did a great job in helping me really understand how what you call, I'm assuming you invented the term singularitists. What are they called?
These dudes. I don't know. Singularitists or singularitans?
Singularitans. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, the people, who believe in the singularity. But that was the impetus for the book. I was on a panel with this guy, you know, one of these famous dudes who thinks he's going to upload his consciousness to a chip.
Yes.
And he was saying, you know, that human beings have to accept that we're going to be replaced by the machines, that evolution is the journey of information towards more complex states. So it went from, you know, atoms to molecules to organelles to organisms to human to society. And now computers are better at information than we are. So we should just pass the evolutionary torch to them and accept our inevitable decline and extinction. And I was like, no, dude, this is terrible. You know, there's a place for humans in the digital future. nature. You know, human beings can do stuff that computers can't. We can get in the soft, squishy places between stuff, not just ones and zeros, but what's in between. A human being, you know, can watch a David Lynch movie and not understand what it meant and still experience that as pleasure, right?
Yes.
That's beautiful. Yes. We could sustain paradox over time. Human beings deserve a place. And he said, oh, Rushkoff, you're just saying that because you're human. Right? like it's hubris. So that's when I said, fine, guilty. I'm on team human.
Yes. You know? I love it. Yeah. May I just want to connect to the Renaissance aspect of it. And what this cleared a lot of cobwebs out of my head, because in my sort of, I don't know, thinking about the Renaissance and wondering what it could be, there was some of that in there, this idea of like, well, maybe the Renaissance is McKenna's end of time. Maybe it's the invention of a time machine. Maybe it's the something so astounding that it completely collapses all of civilization. And I don't think I realized what an empty aspiration that was, and what a kind of complete just denouncement of all the beauty in the world. What you're saying, sustaining paradox over time, it's such a beautiful thing about humans. And humans, then we're fine. But this transhumanist, and I don't want to bash transhumanists too much, because there's things that I think are hopefully going to be part of the...
And beautiful in that vision too.
Yeah, beautiful. But still, you know, once I had a conversation with an author, Mirabai Starr, and she pointed out how in certain ways of thinking in the spiritual community, specifically those that involved impersonalism or the complete sort of merging of the identity into all things, are actually weirdly misogynistic, in the sense that they kind of, in those states of consciousness, how are you going to be a mom? Like, you know, it's a dude thing to be like, you know what I mean? I'm going to go,
totally.
I'm going to put myself in a chip. You raise the baby, I'll be in the chip. You know what I mean?
It's another version of the dudes, you know, throwing frisbee on the beach while the women were back, you know, cleaning their pot, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's a...
That's it. It's like, yeah, y'all do your whatever, your girl stuff. I'll be in the web, baby. See you later. I don't need this body. And it's really, and that's why, you know, that your book got me on Team Human. It helped me remember, oh, yeah, that is what matters. And I'm a dad. Do you have kids yet?
I got a 15-year-old daughter. Oh. I know. It brings you back to the ground in a real way.
It sure does. It sure does. But I want it, just because in your, when you were writing about the Renaissance, you mentioned, and I didn't know this, so I don't even know why I'm thinking about a future Renaissance when I barely know the past Renaissance, but you were talking about going from perspective, 2D to 3D.
Right.
And that made me think, well, maybe it's not holograms or VR. Do you ever speculate that it could be a new way that we look at time?
Well, it's got to be, right? I mean, in the end, it has to be. That would be the fourth dimension. I ended up writing this other book before this called Present Shock, where I was looking at the collapse of time in this kind of, that the always on internet thing, the fact that we can live in this state of, you know, emergency interruption that only 911 operators or whatever used to have to endure. Now we do it, you know, just as a matter of course, with the notifications and all that. And we have these sort of multiple instances of ourselves existing simultaneously. Like, there's your Twitter self is still there, even though we're talking here. God knows, somebody might right now be reacting to something you said yesterday on Twitter, and you're like in the middle of getting canceled without even feeling it because you're not there.
Oh my God.
It's scary, right? It's all that. So when you can't live in more than one place at the same time, yet we're sort of doing that. So it feels like it is the beginning of that thing. If you're on more than one timeline, then you're kind of in the beginnings of time travel.
Whoa. Yeah, like in this, maybe, God, like the QAnon stuff, or just the simple like seeming bifurcation of reality between two main political factions, where you can jump to one news network and see one version of reality, jump to the other one and a completely different version of reality is happening. One version, pandemic, wear a mask, we're all gonna die. This is the great catastrophe. The other one, it's like, well, it's bad, but we need to relax a little bit because it's not that bad. And it's like we're right. seeing.
It is weird. And if two people could have full lifetimes on this planet at the same time, you'd experience those two different narratives, right? They yes. lived in two different. It's like the Philip K. Dick sort of Man in the High Tower. It's like it all depends which show you're watching, right?
Yes. And this, you know, as I do love conspiracy theories, and honestly, I feel a bit bummed that the conspiracy universe has been, you know, infected with Trumpism and with, like, it's been sort of hijacked, if you ask me. I mean,
yeah. I love it too. I love it. I don't object to any of the content, really, of almost any conspiracy theory, even the ones that, you know, have people like me, like, sucking the blood out of children, whatever, you know, go for it, think it. But right. the problem is with this one, with the QAnon one, it's being accepted literally rather than
right.
as this metaphor. And as a metaphor, I mean, it's true, basically. The working class is being infantilized and fucked in the ass, right,
wow.
by the neoliberal elite. Right? So I get it. They are like abused children, not being treated with respect or proper care by their guardians. So I get it, but it's not real. They're not actually. Hillary Clinton is not taking 9-year-old girls and sucking the adrenochrome out of their brains.
Right. You know, you don't.
It feels like it though, and we lose access to that metaphor once we grind it down into literal sense.
Woo! That is wild. Yeah, maybe that's where the sort of the resonance, the sense that this is real is happening because, yeah, I get it. On one level, it's real. On another level, give me a break. I mean, if there was adrenochrome out there by now, we would have heard of it for sure. Like right now, we'd be having this conversation feeling bad because inside we'd be like, well, you know, there is adrenochrome. I've never encountered it, heard of it, seen it. We've both been to Burning Man. It's not there.
No, we would have, if it was anywhere. It would have either been there or I would be able to find it with my Tor browser on the dark web, right?
Yes, it doesn't
but
show
it's not
up.
There. If I could get DMT vape pens, I'd be able to get adrenochrome, right?
Exactly. Yeah. If you can get literally stacks of cocaine bricks off the dark web, you can probably get adrenochrome. But this, you know, this sort of weird schizoid split of default reality between various people is really curious and seems to be weirdly, I don't know, I don't get into astrology that much, but there's this conjunction that's happening. Do you know about this? It's coming up.
Yeah, it's the real age of Aquarius is finally going to hit, like in
yes.
the next few weeks. Yeah, I mean, there's that. I look at, I mean, I guess because I'm more of a media theorist, I tend to look at it as the first effects of the digital media environment. You know, that there's this... Well, on the one hand, digital media environment is so much about memory. Everything's happening, you know, everything's happening in memory the way we're looking at it. But moreover, it's like we relate to our media and our stories more as programs. So it's like I'm on almost like a drug. I'm on QAnon. What are you on? Oh, I'm on MSNBC.
Right.
And so it's like, I'm going to let Morning Joe program me. And, you know, and it's this sense. That's why I wrote this other book, Program or Be Programmed, which is kind of about that in a digital age, your media programs you, and then your behaviors and your attitudes. It's like it's not that the algorithms are going to get us. It's that we are treating ourselves like algorithms, not like human beings.
Whoa.
So we get certain programming and then, you know, and the way I'm judging if it's a good program or not is, does it make the person hard and ideological, or does it make them soft and squishy and open? Like, whatever you're on, I want to be on that, right? You're soft and squishy and open. You are capable, no matter how weird your guest, almost in an Art Bell-like way, you can kind of try on what they're saying. You let it run through you, but you don't
Thanks.
Grab onto it, you know? And that's the thing. some of these programs, they don't let us process them. They try to nest inside us and become our permanent program. And that's the fucked up part.
The cookies. That, you know,
yep.
It's
it is. It's cookies.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
That, clear your cash.
Yeah. 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 That's what it is. It's like these sort of, yeah, this is, again, you know, as I contemplate the incoming neural lace or mesh. Is it lace or mesh? Why did I turn into lace? It's not brain lingerie. It's mesh. Or is it lace?
I like lace. It's like
neural
lace.
Neural lace. What?
That's nice.
The incoming ability. Yeah. I'm wearing black brain lace right now.
All a metaphor. Mesh is a metaphor anyway. So
yeah.
Go with lace.
Yeah. It's the ability to sort of quantify thoughts, potentially download dreams, all these things that the transhumanists dream about. To me, it's the possibility of one day being able to scan my identity and see the variety of these, whatever you want to call them, parasitic or symbiotic memes that are inhabiting, that are hiving inside of me. And so that I could understand, like, because, you know, how much of what we do, of what we're up to, is from what you're talking about, from being implanted with an insidious tightening, whatever you want to call it. What was the comparison you were using between a reed and
a river reed and a cedar tree?
Cedar tree. Like, how many cedar tree style, unrelenting, unshifting, like, tight, brutal ideologies are we currently being inhabited by that we're not even aware of?
I know. And those, you know, when you talk about it, it makes me think those are the splinters. Those are the splinters in your eye, the plank in your eye that Christ was talking about. Wow. It's like you got to take the plank out of your eye before you can take it out of someone else's, because it's in you. You're not even seeing straight, right? You've got an algorithm nested in your vision.
Wow. That's so interesting. And this... did you ever get into The Course in Miracles? You ever gotten into those books at all?
Oh, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I started, you know, just looking at it and reading it, and I didn't do the day-by-day thing. I'm like, fuck that. I'm not going to do daily exercise advice. I was going through it, kind of trying to understand it. It's channeled material, which is interesting, but the idea seems to be something along the lines of, we are like this splinter, or whatever you want to call it, this all the apps running in our identity, they're acting as a kind of, I don't know, perfectly shaped, like if there were a keyhole peering into paradise or something, then all those things have filled that keyhole up. So we're essentially, our very almost identity, or most of what we are, is literally blocking our ability to see. Right. We've been blinded by these things. And don't you feel like some of these splinters, or whatever you want to call them, they're being placed there intentionally? It's like there's an intentionality to it. Why do you think that is? Why would there be people out there? I'm not saying it's Morning Joe necessarily.
Yeah. But no, it starts because it's advertising. That's the television model, right? Is create people's realities for them. That's the way you sell. Or, you know, and I wrote this book way back when called Media Virus, which helped launch viral media. And I didn't realize it was going to become what it became, because I didn't think of it as marketing. I thought of it as sort of cultural agendas, like the Rodney King tape and things like that were happening out of control. But then people looked at it, marketers did, and said, oh, memes. I get it. Memes are the things that we can nest in another person.
Yes.
And only thing a meme does is says, make me. You get a meme in you, and then you're compelled to share it. Like, oh, you know, whatever, the QAnon meme. Democrats are, you know, molesting little children and taking their thing. Once you find out, you've got to tell somebody, because, oh my God, it's so horrible. So we end up becoming like the machine that's played. But you're right. The more of these you have, the more they obscure your ability to see anything else. And now that we spend all our time on these meme machines, just looking at scrolling through crap, you know, on these various networks, there's so little left. But, you know, the thing I keep arguing for people to do, just to recalibrate, is just to look look in the eyes of another person, and you reactivate, you know, 800,000 years of evolutionary systems that were designed to allow you to establish rapport and connect and get soft and human again.
I want to ask you, based on what you're saying, where is your inspiration coming from? If the effect of these sort of malicious or ambivalent digital memes is that it produces a dehumanized state. When I'm reading your writing, which is really not just interesting, but good writing, like you're a really good writer. Where's your inspiration coming from? If not these memes, if most of us, you know, like it brings to mind those horrible parasitic, the fungus that gets into creatures and makes them go into the water and shit out these horrible worms. It's like I become that when I'm like coming home to my wife and being like, so did you hear what about the earthquake, COVID, whatever it is, you know, it's like the worm comes pouring out of my mouth. If that's what is the sort of, I don't know, symptom of being infected with these things, where is your inspiration coming from? What is it that has cleared the cobwebs for you, or how are you, where are you sourcing this stuff from?
I mean, one place, and I know you certainly got it too, was, you know, after my daughter was born, when she was like, you know, 1 year old and would just like lie on my chest naked or whatever, you know, you get this, some kind of oxytocin rush, but it's more than that. It's like the whole evolutionary something just happens and you're like, oh my God, I've been with this soul so many times and now I'm the grown up and she's the baby, but she's trusting me. And this thing happens when you realize, and once you connect to that, you get that feeling, then you can see, you can see and feel kind of echoes of that, you know, depth of connection in all sorts of things. I mean, for me, it's always looking for the liminal, like the soft, squishy places. When you find, I used to walk around New York City just looking for other people who weren't on their smartphone and make eye contact with them. And it's like, you're part of this secret conspiracy of that, you know, it's like, we're not the body snatched. Oh, there's another one. And you almost have a smile with them of like, ooh, I get it. Hi. So there's them. Or, you know, like I said, like David Lynch, just watching Twin Peaks: The Return, or listening to a Neil Young record, or your show. I mean, there's these people and places that go in the in-between, the unguarded in-between liminal place, and it's like, oh, they're here. So it's, for me, it's kind of live people, and then the artifacts of people who are celebrating and recording those liminal experiences, the in-between space.
When was the last time that you found yourself in the valley of the shadow of death, in a place, you know what I'm talking about? Like, your energy, it feels so beautiful and optimistic and real. And that's why everyone loves your books. And that's why, how often do you find sometimes I just find myself, not lately, but lately I've just been feeling this, you know, basic elemental joy about being a dad and having a family. And I love it and it's wonderful, but there's a piece of me that's like, oh man, how long before you land back in that place where you are numbed down? You are completely lost in the phone. You are doom scrolling, as they say. When was the last time that happened to you, or does it happen to you anymore?
Yeah, a week or two ago. You know, it happened to the point I actually had a signal talk with a friend, and I actually cried because I was so there. This, you know, one of my very best friends in the world who'd been a light, you know, what I thought anyway, a light QAnon thinker, user, after the election happened, he got really mad at me. He said, you know, you got blood on your hands. This, you know, Biden is going to, you know, he's going to resurrect the war machine and the kids of all these, you know, red state, you know, truck driving people that you don't like, you know, they're going to all go to war and die. And this is on your hands. I'm so, you know, I hope you relish that.
Whoa.
And I was like, oh man, man. I mean, and I just didn't know, you know, I've had my own cult experiences, certainly even back in the cult, in the Course of Miracles days, you know?
Yes.
I experimented with stuff and I know what it's like to start believing in a system more than anything else. But this was so, it hurt so much because I walk around, I mean, like you, I walk around with my soft, squishy underbelly just open. Here I am, this vulnerable, softest, stickiest little part of me is just open, especially with my friends, and for someone to go in and just stab right on it. It was like, it was worse than losing any girlfriend I ever lost or anything. It was just brutal. And so it was a dark place. I don't know if it was that I was so programmed or something, but capable of being hurt by the program, you know, really being hurt.
It's you made a brilliant observation saying that this weird sort of data like split, this schizoid parallel info timelines that we're all living in simultaneously is a sort of the result of us getting used to technology. Then your friend and friends, I have friends like that, not quite as bad. No one's like turned the knife in my stomach yet, but certainly I have experienced a distance, to say the least, between people who you know, subscribe to that ideology. And it's a casualty. It's some kind of, I mean, this QAnon thing to me, it just smells like, and saying this makes me sound like one of them, it smells like a psyops. It smells like an intentional, like some kind of intentional attack. Doesn't it feel like that to you?
I know. That's the way I thought about 911 conspiracies, because the open conspiracy was bad enough. We trained the guy. I mean, just the regular news story is so damning that the crazy news stories, you know, the conspiracy theories distract us from the true real world crimes that happen without even going to the weird place. So I suspect that a lot, that these are that. But you know, in answer to your real question, I have felt myself fall into the program. Like one of the programs is in the digital age, and with us now publishing and content creators, you want to be the guy who came up with the thing and gets credit for it, right? If you come up with a great joke and you see, you know, some other comedian doing it, it's like, fuck, man, that was my bit. And they're, you know, and you don't want to get mad, but you do, because it's like, I want credit for that. So, you know, when I went into that, these guys, there are these guys, they did this movie, The Social Dilemma, about, social media and all that. And these guys are all like quoting my stuff with no credit and all. Ooh. And I'm like, all right, whatever. I got to look at it as good. You know, these are the first bad guys I was able to chip off from the big digital machine. I'm going to be above it. They're using my words. I don't need credit. I don't need that. And then they call me and say, we're going to launch a new website. We want to make sure it's okay with you, but you know, we're calling it Team Humanity.
What?
It's like, dude, I just wrote a book called Team Human. You can't just go and
that's so messed up.
I got so mad, but it was so I didn't get mad on the surface with it. I said, good, it's fine, it's whatever. And I quickly made a YouTube saying, look, there's this thing coming out. We've got to welcome these guys. They're just tech bros. They need to feel like it's their thing, like they came up with it. So just welcome them. And someday maybe they'll, you know, realize that we're all doing the same thing. But inside, I'm thinking, goddamn motherfuckers, you know, this is my thing. I want credit. Why do I always end up, running around trying to sell 6 books, and, you know, millionaires are out there and bam. And that's when I realized, no, wait a minute. You're in the program. You're in capitalism. You're stuck looking for credit, looking for money, you know, and not really doing the thing that I'm preaching, which is, you know, just be the change. Just engage with people and watch how things change. They're changing. They're coming to my side, and I'm not welcoming it because I want credit. You know, so that's me falling into the trap.
Gosh, you know what? I've gone to so many Ram Dass retreats, and I've seen some of these great teachers speak, and I've marveled at their patience doing exactly what you've done, which is like, for sure, you talk about like people, like with in comedy, it's if you are identified as a joke thief, you just hang up, you're done, hang up. It might not happen right away, but you will. There's some, it self-polices, and it's doom. You can't steal jokes. You just can't. It won't work, at least in the before times. I don't know, maybe now. But in the spiritual community, you know, this is a thing that happens, which is that people's writing gets lifted. People get some of their main core, like pillars of their teachings just get lifted, and with zero credit. And if they were to even, you know, show any sign of being pissed off, it would almost negate their teaching, you know? Right. And so it's a beautiful thing when you watch them relinquish that and they really don't care. And you realize they don't. It's fine for them. They're doing the dandelion in the wind thing. It's right. Really,
but the people who rip it off, they're denying themselves the connection to the legacy.
Yes.
In other words, they value this idea that of novelty. I've come up with something new, the new thing. And what they've lost touch with, you know, as you get back in older religions, you know, in the myth of eternal return, there's nothing new under the sun. You can't say something new. That the indigenous people got this, that there's the gods have already done it. Someone before you has done it. You know, they had two circles. Everything you do is an imitation of something that went before,
right.
And everything's going to come back. Everything reincarnates. And once you accept that, it's like you want, it's going to feel better if you can accept the resonances of the thing that you said. It's your legacy. It's your elders. It's your teachers. It's your partners.
Yeah.
They are denying themselves the privilege of rapport, of comrades, of solidarity.
That's sad.
Again, because they're stuck in the last renaissance, in the individual, in the cult of the individual.
And you know what else they're doing is it's like the other thing that's great about citing people, when you can remember that you are saying something that they said, is that you connect everyone. You know, it's like, it's a gift. It's like when I'm quoting Sharon Salzberg, I like to say Sharon Salzberg, not just because I don't want to be the person who ripped off Sharon Salzberg, which would make me just feel like the worst person on earth, but also I want people to find Sharon Salzberg. It's like they're cutting people off from you and your great books, right. And that's robbery.
Exactly. We're all trailheads to each other, you know?
Yeah. We're all links, you know? You want to like create like a... to me, this is the... part of, if I'm going to drop into like a creeped out despair state, the way that I'm going to do it is by recognizing how quickly history, lineage, connection, truth can just be obliterated, can just be wiped out. Do you know what's the name of that great conspiracy theory? It's Big Mud. Have you heard this one? You know what I'm talking about?
No.
It's like I'm saying it wrong. It's basically the idea is that history as we understand it, it's completely wrong. That there was some disaster that happened, not like in the Lesser Dreas, like Graham Hancock says, or not like in the last ice age, but like 500 years ago, 600 years ago. Something happened. The world got wiped out. And history got completely rewritten. Now, I obviously, it wouldn't be that hard for anybody who had, you know, a slight understanding of anthropology or pottery fragments or to be like, no, that's so not true. Like, how do you explain carbon dating on certain things? But again, if you look at it as the metaphor, ooh, it's scary to think like how in the same way you just got like iced by these people, and just wiped out. And in that wiping out, they take all the credit, complete and rob people from being able to go dive deeper into your philosophy, but which is a kind of a form of a weird kind of murder, but it's a tiny little part of this other possibility. You write about the Renaissance. You write about Team Human, about this impending, beautiful, decentralized, communal, yet somehow the main, we can maintain our identity. We can share and still, without turning into some communist, you know what I mean, empty void. Don't you feel like there is another way it could go? Don't you feel like there's another way with all this beautiful technology? That it presents obviously the beauty of the Team Human style Renaissance that you're talking about, but it also presents the possibility of something so incredibly sinister that I almost don't want to talk about it. Jaron Lanier talks about it. This Skinner box thing where the AI hypnotizes us completely, keeps us magnetized to specific timelines, memes, or whatever you want to call it, and we can't pull ourselves out.
I mean, honestly, it feels more probable than not.
Wow.
You know, if I'm going to be honest, I'm not optimistic. I'm trying to stay hopeful, you know, and maximize the potential for as many of us to get through this as possible. But, you know, we're not breathing together. We're not dancing together. You know, we are still really so caught up in the capitalist myth that it's scary, you know, that we can't arrest these systems, that, you know, we have the ability, of course, to stop global warming and climate change and to deal with refugee crises and all these things. But we don't have the political or economic will. And, you know, I feel like our leaders are telling us that, you know, we can have our cake and eat it too. That, you know, it's like the great reset that the Davos WEF people want to do. You know, corporations now are going to recognize multiple stakeholders. And it's like, yes, we could stay billionaires and fix the world.
Right.
And it's possible maybe they can't. You can only have so many billionaires and a climate at the same time.
Whoa. Right. That's true. Yeah. Right. Yeah. These people are, you know, rolling their eyes at the vast number of folks who are subscribing to QAnon or whatever it may be. They're feeding that fire. They're just enhancing it. They don't seem to understand that they need us to exist. Or maybe they're starting to maybe it is, you know, God. You know, I don't understand communism. I didn't mean to bash it earlier. I don't think I'm smart enough. I've tried.
Well, no, you were bashing totalitarianism, which is a little different.
Right. Yeah. Living in communion is like, to me, I can't, like, outside of like a perpetual orgasm or something. Even that actually, that doesn't sound great. It kills people. Yeah. I've heard of people with a form of epilepsy where they come to death. I don't know if you ever heard of that. Oh. It's a different podcast, but what I'm saying is that in one of my many attempts to try to understand communism by reading Karl Marx, early days, just to upset my dad, because it would just freak him out to see like the Communist Manifesto just laying in my room or something. But Karl Marx writes about this full automation, getting to a point where everything's automated and the people who own the mechanism of automation are going to be the ones who become Bezos, and the people who don't, they're going to be irrelevant. They're not even going to be able to work. There won't be a job for them.
Right.
And doesn't it seem that that's where we're at right now? That's it. Coming.
That's where the wealthiest among us think things are going. I mean, there's this story. I it's in the Team Human book where I thought I was going to go do this talk for these wealthy like hedge funders about the digital future, and it turned out to be just 5 billionaires who wanted advice from me. First, it was like, you know, Ethereum or Bitcoin or, you know, augmented reality or virtual reality, like they're going to put their money somewhere. But then the whole thing was like Alaska or New Zealand, you know, and we spent an hour. I spent an hour with them on the question, how do I maintain control of my security force after the event? Right. So they're going to have their bunker. They're going to be in New Zealand or Alaska or somewhere. And they got the Navy SEALs they hired, but their money's worthless. So how do they make sure that the Navy SEALs protect them? So these guys, you know, they're already planning. Right. They're taking 20% of their money and planning for the apocalypse, for the climate change or global unrest or economic crash or electromagnetic pulse or plague or whatever it is that makes the world unlivable. But their model is to leave the rest of us behind, right?
Wow.
So they're going to get off the planet with their spaceship, if they can, you know, get to Mars with Elon Musk, or go underground for a century or two until the zombie apocalypse is over. But if that's, they get it, right? So they've been going since the Renaissance. They've been traveling west, earning money, going with exponential growth, and now building digital technology, and now they realize, oh shit, you know, where it's like the coyote off the edge of the cliff. They've gone, they're there. You can't build out any more society to sustain them. So they are as aware, they believe more than we do in the inevitability of a major event crash, horrible thing. And when those guys, if these are the winners. These are the winners of the digital economy.
Oh my God.
Are the ones who believe that. So, I mean, God. And I don't think it's that they see better than we do. I think it's that they're living life in this kind of insulation equation. It's like, how much money can I earn? How much money do I need to earn in order to insulate myself from the reality I'm creating by earning money in this way?
You know, wow.
And you can never get there. It's like some asymptote. You can't ever reach that. It's like, how do I build a car that drives fast enough to escape from its own exhaust? You know, you're going to come back around the other side of the planet eventually and you'll be in it, right?
I got to know, what was the answer for the security force? Like, how do you keep your security force from just taking over your bunker?
I told them if they want the security force to take care of them in 10 years when they're in the bunker, then like pay for their daughter's bat mitzvahs now.
Wow.
That's what I told. They didn't like that answer. But you know what I was... But you know what I'm saying. It's like, be nice. Be fucking nice, man. You know, it's like not shock collars, not the secret combination to the safe. It's like if 10 right. years from now, they are thinking about killing you to get into the safe. And then they remember right before they pull the trigger, oh, right, he paid for my daughter's bat mitzvah. I can't kill this guy. You know, that's that's the way to engender the trust for later.
I think the bat mitzvah gets you 2 years max, maybe, not even that. I just think it's
better than nothing.
You know, I interviewed somebody who had they had purchased one of these. God, I don't know, massive underground bases that the U.S. military had been using. And I think it was in a limestone. It was in limestone or something. It's still there. And they were basically, you could buy a lot inside this massive, massive cave where you could put your, you know, Airstream. So it's like a more of a middle class, even though Airstreams are not middle, they're expensive, but it's a way that, you know,
low level
billionaires, you know, you got to get there. You got to get there. But if you can get there, then you're going to be in this massive dark cave. The pitch that the guy had was he was going to have a wine bar. There was going to be a wine bar, and he had on display, an RV with some AstroTurf in front of it, with a playground set on it in the darkness of this cave. And I'm looking at this guy, he's a big guy, and I'm just thinking, how long before this guy calls a meeting where he makes himself the lord of this universe? How long before he gets a message from God telling him that, you know, look, stop getting your wife's pregnant. It should just be me. How long? And that security force question, man, that's keeping some people up at night to this day, isn't it? It is.
And that, because that's one of the most common questions I get asked by these people. But, you know, the real answer is instead of trying to earn enough money to insulate yourself from the damage you're creating, spend your effort making the world a place that you don't need to insulate yourself from.
Right.
You know, it's a much, much better bet.
Right.
Is avoid apocalypse than how to survive the apocalypse.
But I can't remember the book. I wish I could. It was an essay. It was talking about how if what's happening here from an evolutionary perspective is the wealthy have become a kind of economic Galapagos, and they're breeding with themselves. They're living with themselves. They've created these enclaves. I believe this person, gosh, I wish I could remember who it was. He uses the term, or she uses the term, economic force fields, essentially. So you create these, you know, you're not, there's so many places in the world where maybe you, I don't know. I know I'm never going to make it to the Bohemian Grove. It drives me crazy. I just want to go. But within these little sort of bubbles, not just conversations are happening, but people are reproducing, people are marrying, people are, and within that, almost like I guess the hypothesis here is it's creating a new species, that it's creating a branch or something. It's creating another thing, and it's not us, and they don't care. You know, I sound like I'm trying to do it's been overplayed, that great George Carlin bit, but it's like, it's not like they care. They don't, when you tell them that, they're like, no, they don't think of us in the same way because they haven't been hanging out with us maybe for centuries. And if they have been hanging out with us, it's only because we're cleaning their houses. We're bringing them food. I have a friend who used to work at one of these fancy, super elite places as a waiter. He would bring people, you know, drinks at the pool. And he said, they don't tip. They don't understand the concept of tipping. Like they don't do it. They don't look at you like you're a human. So to me, that's the other. I don't know why I'm getting so dark with you, because
they don't want to interact with you. I mean, that was, you know, the big stoned insight I had when I was reading about Thomas Jefferson's dumbwaiter. You know, that I remember being taught as a kid, oh, look what a great invention this is. So the servant doesn't have to walk all the way up the stairs with the food. They just put it in this thing and you pull a string and it arrives.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that's not why Thomas Jefferson had it. He had it so he and his dinner companions wouldn't have to look at the slave.
Wow.
Right? The food would just arrive like from a Star Trek replicator there.
Wow.
So yeah, it's that sense of wanting to insulate. But the fact is, what things like COVID are showing is they can't insulate. They can't insulate. The bugs get in.
Yeah.
You know, the air gets in. There's just no hermetically sealed tank in a mountainside in Utah that you can go in. And even if you do, you're gonna fucking die in there. You know?
Right.
There's not going to be light. There's not going to be love. You and your blue blood lizard companions, you know, are de-evolving in order to survive rather than evolving forward. Because evolution, and this is the whole point of that Team Human book, evolution is a team sport. That evolution is not about the survival of the fittest individual. That's not what Darwin was saying. What Darwin was saying, page after page, if you read it, it's like, look at how species are collaborating and cooperating in order to ensure mutual survival. That the path of evolution is towards greater collaboration and cooperation between the members of the species. So if we're going to evolve forward as humanity, it's because we are working together. We're establishing better rapport, better solidarity. We know, as smart people, as loving people, we know the whole object of the game is to connect with others, and isolation kills you. Babies that don't have their touch of their mothers, they die. They quite literally die. Getting fired from a company that you've worked at a long time is experienced as traumatically as losing a leg. And that's because we thrive on connection with others. So these people who are disconnecting themselves from their fellow humans, They're killing themselves. They're in a suicide pact, and that's why they're thinking about the end of the world, because their world is ending, and we just have to hope they don't take ours along with them.
So now I'm gonna, just to italicize what you just said, I'm going to read a small bit from this wonderful Bukowski poem called Born Into This Dinosauria. Have you heard this poem before?
I don't know. Read it.
It's so great. But it says, the rich, this is like towards the end of it, the rich and the chosen will watch from space platforms. Dante's Inferno will be made to look like a children's playground. The sun will not be seen and it will always be night. Trees will die. All vegetation will die. Radiated men will eat the flesh of radiated men. The sea will be poisoned. The lakes and rivers will vanish. Rain will be the new gold. The rotting bodies of men and animals will stink in the dark wind. The last few survivors will be overtaken by new and hideous diseases. And the space platforms will be destroyed by attrition, the petering out of supplies, the natural effect of general decay, and there will be the most beautiful silence never heard. I mean, I think in our conversation, this, you have illuminated a real problem, and it's the problem of ignorance and the ignorance of how we are interdependent. And so let's say I am a lizard person listening to this right now. Let's just say by some impossible stroke of either good or bad fortune, I don't know, Rupert Murdoch, you know, just randomly picks this podcast and is like shuddering and listening. And he suddenly hears, he's like, yeah, he's, Rushkoff's right. What have I done? What do I do, Rushkoff? What do I do? What do they do? I mean, what does it look like in a real world way, where it's not about making sure our security forces don't kill us, but what you're talking about in Team Human, what do these people do? Because that's the first part of the question. The second part is there anything they could do, or is it more of like a bottom up thing that has to happen? Something that we do that hopefully, I don't know, soaks in to their enclaves and bomb shelters.
Well, in some way, they already did the good thing by mistake. You know, so these are the westward ho people that, you know, since the invention of text and the ability to write down our history and write contracts into the future, they've been living in this very linear time scale where everything is the future and progress and go forward, you know, and we got colonialism and slavery and exploitation and all those horrible things. And they went west and built more and had the industrial age and now the digital age. And what they didn't realize was that when they built all these digital technologies, digital was different. Digital is cybernetic. Cybernetic, it means it has feedback. There's feedback loops. It comes back.
Right.
So the very last stage of this extremely linear culture ended up being circular. They're getting the feedback loops from all of the media and all of the stuff that they created. It comes back. So you get it in the form of, yeah, sure, crazy things like QAnon, but you get it even with BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter and Twitter. And nobody knows, a corporation doesn't know, are they responding to our message or are we responding to their message? The cause and effect, the call and response has gone away. So Fox News, Murdoch's evil propaganda empire, Fox News is a feedback. They're just putting what's on Twitter. They're not generating. They're feeding back. They're part of a cycle. Right. So they've lost control, which is a good thing. So, you know, they pushed so far that they created their opposite, that the original vision for the whole thing, which was, you know, Francis Bacon back in the Renaissance saying, empirical silence will give us the ability to take nature by the forelock, hold her down, and submit her to our will. Whoa. You know, it was a rape fantasy. That's what science was supposed to be, a rape of nature and women. That finally, they raped it so hard, it's coming back. It got pregnant. It's pushing through, right? Their feedback mechanisms are happening. So they've been hoisted on their own petard, you know, in that way, which I'm happy about. But in terms of if and when one of the billionaires comes to me and says, what do I do? What do I do? 90% of the time, what they're really asking me is, what do I do for myself and my family? You know, so I'm going to still make this evil, capitalogical, addictive technology for everyone else's kids. But What do I do with my own? Should I send them to Rudolf Steiner or Montessori? Should I, you know? It's always their thing, right? Usually. But what I would tell someone who actually cared is first scale down. You can't do anything at scale, at corporate scale. It just doesn't work. These are monsters. These corporations, they are truly monsters. They are alien gods that cannot exist. They cannot coexist with human beings. That they should start living their life at scale, which means walking on the ground, looking into other people's eyes. I would tell them, take 10 minutes a day to sit with another human being and not do anything.
Wow.
Just see if you can tolerate 10 minutes with a person and then work up from there, you know?
Yeah.
So it's sort of that, because what happened is they've decalibrated, whether it was capitalism or staring at stock charts or looking in computers, they've decalibrated their human organism. Their soul has not spoken to them in so long. They've auto-tuned. They've really auto-tuned their soul. And, you know, it's what happened to Pharaoh in Torah. You know, God says, I'm going to harden his heart, the Pharaoh, when he was being so mean.
Wow.
His heart gets hardened. And that to me means he lost his free will. His heart was hardened. He could no longer have free will. He could only do the awful thing. He could only not let the Jews go or the Israelites leave or whatever it was. And these folks too, I think that they've calcified or concretized, frozen their free will. You know, they've gone into full petrified wood cedar stage, you know?
Yeah.
And so they've got to soften. They've got to, and the only way to do that is to be, really, you got to reconnect with others. So find your wife or your mistress or your child or whatever it is you got, look in their eyes, you know, and that will recalibrate. Breathe in sync with the other person. You know, it's so simple. But once you do, one of those guys, if Rupert Murdoch looked at a person in his life in the eyes and breathed in rhythm with that person, he would weep. He might weep for the rest of his friggin' life. You know what I mean? Because if even 1% of his soul opened and started to experience reality, boy, you know, I wouldn't want to be in there for that.
Wow! Douglas, thank you so much for this gift of getting a conversation with you. You are brilliant. This has been one of my favorite podcasts of all time. And thanks, Connor, Habib, Zach Leary. Thanks for everybody who connected us, because this was just incredible. I am so grateful for your time here today.
I'm so grateful for what you do. I mean, it's such a gift to all of us just to watch people go on the show, on the TV show, on Midnight Gospel, to watch the process of reincarnation happen. Of all your stuff getting mashed up and going on the assembly line, but you're having a conversation through the whole thing and you make it to the other side with your friends and keep going.
Yes.
It just made me feel so much better about this whole wheel that we're on.
Thank you.
So thank you for that.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad I'm on the wheel with you, and I'm glad I'm getting chopped up with you. Looking forward to whatever we get reconfigured as. Would you mind letting people know where they can find you?
Oh, easiest place, I guess, is rushkoff.com or teamhuman.fm.
Thank you. I don't mean to be greedy, but will you come back on the show someday?
Oh, anytime. I'll come back in an hour. I love you.
I love you. Thank you so much. This is amazing.
Thank you.
That was Douglas Rushkoff, everybody. You can find out all about Mr. Rushkoff at rushkoff.com. A big thank you to our sponsors. Remember, by supporting them, you support us. And a big thank you to you, my human family, for continuing to listen and support the DTFH. I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.